variety, because just the same thing with labels, right? Because that's the same kind of label people use.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah, there's a lot of distortion there. Okay. Welcome to another episode of Just Another Bozo on the Bus. Bozo Roundtable, episode number 2. All right. Welcome. We're going to go around and introduce ourselves real quick. I'm Paul Randeck. I'm your host.
I'm Matt Johnson. Not your co-host.
Good to see you, Matt. It's been a little while.
Yeah, been a minute.
Thanks for appearing.
It's funny because I was going to say Brady, co-host.
Yeah.
You said not
your
co-host.
Go ahead.
Well, I did. I said it. No, I'm not your co-host either. Brady.
Brady. Welcome back, Brady.
Brent Hansen.
Hey, Brett.
I'm Sarah Robotham.
Sarah.
And we're Robotham. All Robotham.
Yeah.
Robotham.
Let's make sure Paul doesn't hit this time.
Yeah,
we went to a place called Cape Foulweather, and we decided we had to say it like Foulweather, because it's... Anyway.
Does that... You want to say my last name, too?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Robotham.
It is English.
Who invited this guy?
And we waited for him and everything.
You know what you were getting into.
Okay, well, we have we're back here together, gathering, and we've got a menagerie. How'd you like that? A menagerie of topics to discuss today.
All whipped out his dictionary, apparently.
That's one of my favorite words, actually. So Brady had a few right off the bat that I thought we should start with, unless somebody has something they want to share that's been happening in their life recently over the past month that's been standing out. We can take a moment and kind of talk about that. We'll come back around to that. Yeah, I thought we should talk about Sarah's dating life, but I wasn't sure.
Yeah, that's why you look. I'm like, I have a feeling you're going to bring that up.
Okay.
Maybe next time.
I'll be nice. Okay. Where do you want to start, Brady? You had a pretty good list there.
Well, my central theme, and Brett and I talked about it, was just maybe conversation about happiness and how our ideas on what that is meant, what that looks like, and how that has just evolved and changed over time. Because I think, at least for me, I know it's definitely shifted and changed a lot, right?
Is it partly what I guess I want to ask is partly what you think happiness is, or is it just what happiness evolves when you go through life changes?
Yeah, just how it evolves. Like, I used to think happiness was a wise pursuit. Like, it was something that you could have 100% of the time, and that was like the goal.
Uh-huh.
And that has shifted in where I don't look at it like that. And I don't know. I just thought that might get the ball rolling to some interesting.
Well, there is this story kind of woven into our culture, our society. In fact, I think I talked about this in the book. This idea of the right to pursue happiness. You know, and what does that? But what does that mean? What does happiness mean? Because I think sometimes it's really individual,
mm-hmm.
or it can be individualized. So when you think of happiness, I'm curious what comes up. But because we can talk about joy, bliss.
Yeah, I don't really like the word happiness, kind of.
Oh, man, he's a miserable cuss.
No, it's not that I'm a miserable cuss. I don't think it's like a pursuit that you can... I think it's realistic or healthy to believe I can be happy all the time, right? And I think in the past, I've got caught up in trying to do that and feeling like a failure because I'm not happy all the time, and so you sort of set yourself up for failure.
Yes.
And that's just been a learning process. I remember when I got out of treatment, I was pumped full of this idea that positive thinking is the way to like live life, right? Just be positive now, be happy now. And I really drank that Kool-Aid and started to feel like I needed to drink that Kool-Aid all the time, even when it was like inauthentic.
So is it like the idea that just I'm going to pursue happiness just for the sake of pursuing happiness?
Exactly.
Because that's what I'm supposed to do.
And everyone's got to see me happy, and I got to project this vision of, look, oh my God, Grady's happy. When it's like, whoa, fuck that. Like, that doesn't, like, you know what I mean? When I'm
or I'm okay when I'm happy, or people think I'm okay when I'm happy?
Yeah, and just you know, yeah. Like, for me, I know happiness, I'm more happy after something difficult, right? Like a challenge. Like, I think exercise is a great, like, micro expression of life, because you go into running, for example, and you run for, like, for me, like, you run for 5 or 6 miles, and you go through this gamut of emotions where it's, like, painful, it's emotionally challenging, it's physically challenging, but then you may hit this zone or this flow state where it's, like, bliss, you know, and then afterwards you may have the high, and it just cultivates, like, a certain level of happiness for me, but it's not all happy, and it's not all meant to be happy. Like, the duality of life, you know, is real. And I used to, like, in Refuge Recovery, it talks about seeking a permanent state of intoxication. Like, and that's outside of just intoxicants. That was my, like, permanent state of happiness, permanent state of pleasure.
Like chasing the endorphin. That's kind of what you're saying.
Yeah, okay. And just how just that view has, I think, set me, you know, I just reframe that. That's just not, you know, that's not realistic, and that's not something for me that works, and I don't think it is for anyone, right?
Okay.
I feel like I had that a lot in treatment, and you and I have talked about that a little bit. And one of the other parts that played into that was the people around me, because when I went into treatment and felt kind of at a low of my life, and then got kind of pumped full of all this energy, and when I got out, I was really happy, and it most of the time felt authentic. But as I started getting back into my life and my everyday, okay, this is still life, and there are going to be hard days and things, I noticed the people around me starting to worry anytime I wasn't just, like, super high on life, you know? Like,
right.
Oh, is she going to, you know?
You seem a little down today, Sarah. Are you okay? Is everything all right?
And they were worried enough that I started kind of second-guessing myself, too. Like, if I can't maintain this, you know, constant happiness, does that mean I can't stay sober, or that I'm not living my best sober life if I'm not maintaining this really positive outlook on every day? And I feel like there are some people that try and do that it maybe works for better, but for me, I had to find a balance, and it had to be realistic that there are days that I'm not, and that's okay too, and there's times I'm not, and the people around me, you know, I mean, I think it's been long enough that they're not worried anymore, but that was, I felt like I was always walking on eggshells. If I wasn't happy, I had to pretend to be, to make sure people weren't worried that I was going to be relapsing or something.
Yeah, put the mask on, right? Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
Pretend to be is something that almost taught to us in certain aspects, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of what Brady was talking about, the positive thinking, to always try to maintain some level of positivity. Even, I think it's just moderation. It's the pursuit of happiness. It's not all the time happiness.
Yeah, and the idea that one's always happy, talk about thinking irrationally.
Yeah,
I mean, there's, first of all, that's not possible. I mean, because you're talking to, I mean, and I don't know, maybe it is possible. Maybe there's a possibility.
No, it's not, Paul.
Okay, all right. But I haven't discovered it.
It's bullshit.
I mean, okay, so I'm going to just say, I don't want to be happy all the time.
I think it goes against, like, physics, too.
You'd have to be an insane
enjoy without the pain kind of thing, right? Like, we do.
you're going to burn out. You're going to totally just rewire your brain.
You wouldn't know what happiness is if you were happy all the time.
If it was all the time.
Well, that goes back to the non-attached appreciation a little bit that we were maybe going to talk about later, but kind of how can you appreciate, you know, when you do have those moments of happiness if you're not also experiencing moments of, you know, disappointment or sadness?
Yeah.
It's harder to decipher between the two, then.
I mean, there wouldn't really be much room for nostalgia.
I know.
I pulled that out. We didn't do that in the actual second episode, did we?
No, we didn't. That was a good talk.
So. Yeah, it is a good. And I also have you know, thought about this idea, and I think maybe this is what you were talking about too, Brady, a little bit of what it's like to have what our concept of happiness is. Yeah. Because there's definitely beliefs around it, right? It's not just, it is a feeling, right? It's a chemical feeling, but there's also the thoughts about what happiness is. I mean, we could talk about this from a relational dynamic of what it's supposed to be like in a, you know, in a relationship. Am I, are all my relationships supposed to be happy? And if they're not, is there a problem? You know, I mean, maybe in early, you know, before people get into a place where they have some self-actualization or identify their core belief systems, you know, maybe, and we could talk about that from the perspective of, you know, before they get, someone gets into recovery or lives a sober life, that their idea of happiness may be much different, especially what it looks like in a relational dynamic. And the expectations in relationships about happiness are probably, for the most part, skewed anyway, until, you know, you have a long-term relationship and have all the ups and downs of it, you know. The idea that I'm always going to be happy in a relationship.
I wonder why that is, too. TV.
TV video culture games. Conditioning.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe it Leave it to is, Beaver though. Or something. I don't know.
Leave it to Beaver, yeah.
Yeah. I used to, I love that movie Pleasantville for that,
I
that
love
reason.
That too,
yeah. The black and white one.
Yeah. That's, yeah.
And it turns,
so well done.
And then they, and then people start to see in color, and then the colors yeah. start to change.
Once
and,
they start to experience actual other emotions yeah. besides just
fake,
yeah,
happiness.
Fake happiness.
Yeah.
That is.
Honey, I'm home. Where's dinner?
Wait, and she doesn't come with it, and he's
that's
all,
normal, though.
That's Matt's life.
But Matt, that's your life.
I'll get okay. my ass kicked every talk.
I think a lot of times, like, when, at least for me personally, growing up, when I think back, what did I, or, you know, what did I think happiness was going to be? It was always like an end game. It was always like, you know, I'll be happy when I have this, this, and this. And I really neglected a lot of, like, experiencing happy moments throughout life because I hadn't achieved whatever that thing was that I was striving for that was going to ultimately make me happy. And so, but now I feel like, and they discussed this, and it was something that I got from Refuge Recovery, too, that happiness isn't an end game. It's not a complete. It's not possible to always sustain a happiness all the time. And happiness is really more is closer to acceptance and contentment than it is to actual pleasure. And so, and it's when you're really willing to have like an open and compassionate heart and feel. And feel whatever it is in the present, that's when you can really achieve, you know, happiness in the moment. And it's not an end game, per se.
Well, this, and we can jump right into we can weave non-attachment appreciation into all of this, because the idea of happiness and detaching from things leads more into this notion, at least I feel, that it really becomes more about contentment or some level of feeling whole.
Right. Acceptance, yes.
Acceptance, yeah. and that sense of maybe this also maybe accountability plays into this too, that I'm okay, and I'm content in my being, human being.
Again,
sort of this idea of not having to be even attached to a concept of what happiness is, it's kind of like. I mean, I'm not trying to go, you know, mind exploding kind of thing here. This is, I think it's simpler than that. But whatever our belief system is, that with the story that we have, I'll be happy when.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. And that means that happiness is being pursued based upon some kind of condition. And maybe the non-attachment part of that is not having happiness be attached or associated with anything, but just being able to find it in the moment in where we're at. And who knows? I mean, you know, again, back to the I talked a little bit about this in a podcast a few months ago with Jake, this idea of he brought up the whole idea that I'm a menagerie. I'm a Crayola, a large Crayola box of emotions, you know, and that I'm made up of all these things, and I'm not just a few colors, and that I need to learn, and that for me it's important to be able to express all of those. We talked about this in the other night a little bit.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And how does that fit in? Because to our sense of, you know, personal well-being and our sense of personal acknowledgement or of ourselves, you know, this notion, because can I be content and happy with myself? And what does that look like? I mean, I see what I kind of sometimes think. I can see it as an absence of things like shame or regret or those negative self-talk. But it must be something much more than that, too. I mean, there must be even beyond beliefs. But what do you guys think about this, of what the expectations of what makes us happy, what's when we're going to be happy when?
Well, like one thing I was just thinking about, I think maybe what I was trying to speak on earlier more clearly is I feel like the most happiness or the most contentment has come through personal growth in just life in general. And I have a part of my belief system that growth really happens from uncomfortable situations.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Like,
sure.
You grow when you're uncomfortable. And so I think part of happiness is taking on, not overwhelming, but challenges, stuff that's difficult in the moment, may not feel happy, may not be how you would define it, but all encompassing, like it leads to that growth. It leads to a fulfilled life, right? Instead of sitting in the basement, which a lot of my 20s, right, was drugs, or like maybe if I wasn't getting super high at the time, it was Netflix and chill. It was sleep, Netflix, you know, like I was just so isolated. And, you know, coming out of that cloud of addiction and that cloud of just disconnection with life, and then being willing to step into, you know, things that are hard and things that are challenging, and realizing in so doing, my life is so much better, you know, mm-hmm. like I just did my second half marathon. And it's been such a fulfilling experience, but what I've noticed already now over the last 2 weeks is I don't have a third one that I've signed up for. And there's been some Netflix and chilling more so than what is probably healthy going on in the past 2 weeks. I feel, you know what I mean? That kept me accountable. And I'm not saying I need to sign up for another race, but having some of that kind of stuff built into your routine lends itself to like this growth and this happiness. But, you know, cultivating it through challenges and through things that are hard or difficult is what seems to be, like, pivotal for me.
So working towards achieving a goal.
Yeah.
I mean, I like the idea. So if I have this thing in front of me, I'm working towards, I'm making strides and steps towards it, then I can feel a sense of accomplishment and
yeah.
I feel
and
joy or happiness
and
from that.
Steps aren't easy, right? I think that's key for me is it's got to be challenging. It's not overwhelming. It's not toxic.
Yeah.
You know? And it doesn't, I keep saying exercise, but it can be work. It can be career oriented.
Something,
right?
Something where you're challenged.
And connection oriented. It can be sharing your story at a treatment center and building up to that could be something, right? Where it's like, well, that's intimidating, but you get that release from it. And so, you know, that, I mean, that's just a big part of what I'm trying to cultivate. And I feel like what I'm learning on this journey, like with it.
Cool.
What you said reminded me of the book in the book, The Happiness Equation, where he talks about one of the things that you can do to, you know, to be happier, or one of the components of happiness is to be in flow. He's like, in quote, flow, and flow is engaging in highly skilled or highly challenging activities with a high level of skill, and where those two things meet is when you're in flow. And that kind of goes along with what you're saying. You're doing challenging things, and you're seeing the benefits and the rewards from it.
For sure.
That flow.
Those flow states, that zone state, they talk about that. That's so,
I feel like for me, that's a huge part of my stuff, because I have spent the last, year and a half doing so many things that have made me uncomfortable and have found happiness or some form of it, whatever, you know, you want to call it, contentment, joy, in those things, like with my career change and with certain things through recovery and just a lot of changes and transitions. But even for me, something that where I find happiness is when I'm actually doing nothing. I'm finding more happiness in the moments of nothing and in the moments of like just times of peace. I used to get really anxious when I had nothing to do. I used to get like, I needed to have something planned. I need to have something to look forward to. Always kind of looking for the next step of and whether that was a goal like Brent was talking about earlier, or even just a vacation, or, you know, a long weekend from work, it was always like waiting for the happiness until that time came. And now being able to have, and kind of back to the non-attached appreciation, just being in a moment and just feeling that inner peace and contentment, you know, happiness, I guess, in the moments where I really am doing nothing. And finding that appreciation for those moments and not always waiting for the big thing, or even maybe not even waiting for the uncomfortable or challenging times, but finding it just in the, like, my first couple sips of coffee in the morning when I work really early and open, you know, like, it used to just be part of the routine and it was just to get me through the day, and now I find myself feeling happy in those times. And it, that doesn't mean I'm overjoyed, it just means I'm good.
Overjoyed, I like that.
I'm not overjoyed at 5:30 in the morning, but I would say I'm content and I'm okay. And content, that feels like happiness to me, where I used to feel like happiness needed to feel happy, it had to be
a big event.
Overjoyed, it had to be a big event. Now it's,
it seems like on the other side of having stuff that's challenging and stuff to do is the idea that there's not much going on in your life, and that's what I was dealing with for the last year, really. And you know, you don't even have work to occupy most of your day. It's hard to find happiness or to be content in that situation. So you don't want to be overworked or have too much to do, but I think an important part of being a human is accomplishing something every day.
Finding the balance between those two.
You need balance. And some people work too much and they're not happy, and some people don't work enough and they're not happy. And I think, for me anyway, that lack of stuff to do is brutal. It's hard.
Yeah. So there's something that's coming up that I'm hearing my kids. I mean, I'm hearing decades of children, and I'm hearing the word bored.
How many kids do you have?
I have 37. I have 8 kids.
Okay. But
that's a different time, different story. But anyway, a blended family. But the word bored, I was thinking about this when Sarah was talking, was really boredom is actually anxiety. I think a lot, like, I'm supposed to be doing something, so I'm getting anxious because I feel like things are not filled up and I'm not being able to, you know, direct my energy, even if it's, you know, really to something mindless or not. But boredom is sort of like not the lack of something, it's the maybe the increase of anxiety in our lives. You know, the stress is coming up, or, you know, anxiety that I'm not feeling okay. So I hear that word and I've heard it for so long. Mm-hmm. I'm bored. You know, I need something to do. You know,
boredom's not real.
Yeah, and boredom's just a state of mind. Just, and whereas anxiety is, you know, future tripping about something, of course. You know, so this. By the way, this kind of we kind of take this into the next area that you had brought up, if it's okay, because I think this labeling what makes us happy is, I mean, because we talked about labeling, right? And when we can segue into that, but labeling what makes us happy or defining it as certain things really is a limiting kind of a way to go about life. Because if I say, well, those are the only things that, has anyone ever said this, the only things that really make me happy in life are blank, 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 blank. Like, you know, really define it. Like, I've experienced so many aspects of life that, gosh, I can really define the things that make me happy. And I'm not saying not that those aren't real, the things that make us happy, but often we define it quite narrowly. Yeah. And part of it may be just out of fear of wanting to experience different aspects of life. But to find joy and contentment and happiness in many different ways. You know, and finding new ways to find it. Otherwise, well, I'll just throw it out there. The behaviors become an addiction in some way. It becomes a behavioral addiction, like we're constantly doing the same thing over and over again, you know.
I feel like you're describing the beginner's mind.
The beginner's mind. Yes, perfect. Yes.
So the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. In the expert's mind, there are few.
Yes. And perfect.
I just love that.
Yeah. So with this, if you know, if we're okay with kind of shifting, let's go talk about labels. Let's explore that, because just talking about the idea of happiness can lead us into that sector. But also, you know, we understand the term labels and how they get used. And you brought up, I think, the one of what it means to carry the label of addiction or an addict or being in recovery or those kinds of things. And I brought up the idea of what the label or the idea of what it means to be sober, you know, and there's so many definitions about that for different people. And I bring it up for a couple reasons, but let's just kind of open this up, you know. And yeah, I'm sorry, I thought it was you, but if it was Sarah,
it was my brilliant idea.
It was your brilliant idea. Okay, obviously not my brilliant listening skills. Okay, what were your thoughts on this?
Well, I found it interesting when I first went into treatment, and I guess kind of got out, the idea of, I kind of actually like the idea of what you were talking about being sober, kind of starting with that more so than just the idea of, am I an addict? Am I an alcoholic? But the label of sobriety to me took on a really different meaning. When I first stopped drinking, thinking of that as being my sobriety was all I was, that was my only focus, my only goal was, if I'm not drinking, then I'm living a sober life, which has now developed into pretty much a billion different areas besides just being sober from substance. Uh-huh. For instance, the things we were talking about, am I doing things in my life to bring those moments of contentment and happiness? Meaning, am I doing things that I feel good about myself, that I'm living my authentic life? If I'm doing those things, I feel like that's more sobering to me, and I feel like I'm actually living a sober life versus just not drinking. I think people can stop drinking and be just as or more miserable, you know, in what they call sobriety. So I've really tried to expand on the meaning of sobriety for the last year and a half, in what I would label as sobriety.
Well, I think that really hits it on the head a little bit. This notion of that it really hasn't that or the idea that sobriety is about the substance,
right? And I thought that going in, though. I mean, and I think the people around me thought that, too.
Well, a lot
Once
of people
do. Once you stop drinking, you're sober, and that's enough.
Yeah. Right.
But then sober equals happy.
Right.
And that's the part. That's the part, it's like I thought, if I'm sober, then I'll be happy. Now it's more of the, if I'm happy, living an authentic life for myself, then I will be sober.
Well, and sober, and you probably have heard it over through the years, what my definition of sobriety is, but I'll throw it out there again. It's sobriety is a state of mind. It's a state of being. It's the stopping drugs and alcohol or those kinds of things and not changing the way I think and the way I'm able to emote and regulate my emotions. It doesn't mean correlate to sobriety. It just means I'm dry or clean, you know, from certain substances. And I can go off on all that. I have all these beliefs about, you know, that some of the worst drugs in the world are things like sugar. So I Yeah, sorry. I stopped taking sugar in any forms of any carbohydrates, you know, I go through detox, and it's about a week or two before I kind of get over that. But anyway, that's a completely sort of separate topic to go into. But so when we talk about sobriety, I always think it's not about the drug or the alcohol or the substance or even the behavior as much as it is about the way I think and the way I feel and my ability to be, which we talked a lot about last time, which was being wholehearted or open-hearted. Mm-hmm. and being willing to be vulnerable with people.
Yeah, to me, when I think of sober, I think of not being a victim.
Yes.
Yeah.
That to me is like one of the worst It's like I got drugs in the world is like just this victim mindset.
So true.
That's bad. It just keeps you so small. It keeps you disconnected, you know? And I remember that shift of like, oh, it's all on me. Oh, but then that's great, you know? Like there's just so much benefit to that realization within yourself. Mm-hmm. There's so much like power in it.
Freedom in that.
Yeah.
Just like there's a freedom from not having to take the substance, not needing it all the time. I think you find a freedom in realizing that you're in control of everything that happens and you're not going to expect anyone else to take care of some of that for you.
And it's funny how you can live as a victim but be unaware that you're doing it.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, for so many years. Yeah. Like,
I think that like being drunk on a victim stance, victim narrative, I think that's like you can be drunk on that. I mean, I really believe that is intoxicating.
It is. Yeah. And then when you, for me, like, you know, those kind of things, it's like the aha moments. Like, I had an aha moment around my victim shit where it was like someone, like, pulled the veil back and like revealed to me that I've been a victim for 8 years, like in my own head. And then it's like cringeworthy. Yeah. You know,
it is.
When you think back on it, but it's a part of your process. And so I've tried to, you know, not, you know, sometimes it can be shameful, like, oh, why did I do that for so long, right? But it's just a pivot, it's just a shift, a perspective gain. But man, in my 20s, I feel like I just was a victim.
Yeah.
Entitled.
The world isn't helping me out.
The world owes me.
Well, I really believe that's part of the domestication of humans, is the idea that someone else is responsible for my problems, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's evident, you know, I mean, if all you do were to listen to, you know, cable news, you would think that everything, all the problems are due to somebody else, you know, in the world.
Damn right.
Yeah, right. Damn
someone
right they are.
Blaming someone else.
Yeah. Right. But in reality, if I'm going to change anything to do with my victim narrative, I'm going to have to, it starts with accountability. And this idea of being sober, definitely, I mean, I will throw accountability in there too, because that's, which is what we're, you know, the victim is sort of what stops us, if maybe this is what you're saying, Brady, but it's part of the intoxication too. So being sober means about taking accountability and living authentically.
It's easy to place the blame somewhere else. It's not the easiest thing to realize that it's all on you and that you're responsible for your pursuit of happiness and
for your choices.
For your choices. So, and if you're taking substances or whatever on top of that, it's called slippery slope.
Whee! Speaking of accountability, our favorite, well, not favorite maybe by any means, but the book we're reading, Brené Brown, I don't know if it's in there in a talk, but she talks about being accountable and standing in your authority. It can be like this uncomfortable thing, but it gives you the ability to write the ending to that story. And, you know, that's the benefit of it. That's the reason why you want to gravitate towards that, because now by owning my story, suddenly I have ownership over the story going forward, right? Where if you're not, you don't.
Yeah.
Or at least, it, you know.
Yeah, my story, my editing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I take authorship. Yeah.
That was How do you feel when someone calls you or an alcoholic, going back to the labels? I'm just curious, like, what your guys' take is on that, because
it doesn't bother me. I would never...
Or what you would say to yourself, I guess, as far as... I'm just curious on the label part.
I guess my inner monologue would say, yeah, I used to drink.
Yeah.
Uncontrollably.
Oh. Well, I
don't
was,
anymore.
I was an addict.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
100%, you know? And I still, like, I don't care so much anymore. I used to get caught up in, I'm an alcoholic, and then it was, no, I'm not an alcoholic. And it was like, I believe, you know, one way or the other. And now it's like, I kind of think addiction is a part of the human condition. It's part of how we are. It's part of who we are.
Right.
So I could say I'm an addict, for sure.
Yeah.
I could identify that in certain aspects of my life. I don't feel like I'm an addict in terms of substances today, right? I'm not addicted. Well, caffeine. I'm definitely coffee guy.
Yeah, see, and the only difference is your behavior. So
I'm more fluid
with LaCroix, yeah.
He's new.
Oh, I'm addicted to LaCroix.
Yeah, I'm on my second LaCroix today. So.
God, Paul, it's only 1:30.
I kind of think everyone's an addict in life.
Something, yeah.
So everyone's addicted to something.
Yeah, it's just the behaviors that... You know, when I'm drunk at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, that's different than if I've had a few LaCroix or a cup of coffee at 3 in the afternoon.
That's true. Socially acceptable addiction.
Yeah, and you can see why. I mean,
it does
falling down slobbering at 3 in the afternoon as compared to a little caffeine buzz or just had a candy bar. A little different.
A little different than I just, you know, shot up some heroin.
Yeah, maybe.
Like there's levels.
Yeah. So you can see why it's...
Did a couple of lines of coke. I'm ready to go back to work.
I went through this big phase of trying to figure out, like, so am I always going to be an addict? Am I always going to be in recovery? Am I not? And this, like, inner battle. And now I think I'm kind of to what you said. But I did the same thing with religion. Am I atheist? Or am I... you know, I had to be something.
Yeah.
And now I kind of have fallen into this just kind of an I don't care middle bubble of everything. Like, you know, I'm not gonna claim myself as any certain thing as far as religious or even in recovery. I mean, I'm not saying I don't, you know, bring up to people that I'm in recovery, because that's an easy way to explain why I don't drink, and you know, that is part of my life. But it weighed on me for a while trying to decide, am I always gonna be alcoholic? Am I always going to be in recovery? I think I've kind of just stopped.
Well, I'm curious, what's your answer today?
I don't care.
Call me what you want.
I think that I'm going to be constantly working. I think we talked about this a little bit in the last podcast. I don't want to repeat, but just kind of that I think I'll always be working on myself, but I don't know if I'm necessarily going to feel like I'm always an alcoholic. I don't believe that. If I'm not actively in my addiction, I don't feel like I'm...
You don't have to call yourself sober if you don't. So why do you have to call yourself an alcoholic?
Right. Yeah.
It just doesn't matter to me.
The label to me it doesn't bother me as much as some when I get called that, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But at the same time, I don't really feel the need to, like, use that as a label to define something that I went through a phase of in life.
And it's really to each their own. And I think everyone's, you know, thing will maybe change too, but I know a lot of hardcore, but identifying as an alcoholic, identifying as an addict on the daily in groups, that is such an empowering part of their life, right? And they find their tribe that way, and they connect that way. And some of the, like, more centered and people that I look up to, that's sort of their, you know, their vibe in recovery, and I love it, right? Mm-hmm.
Well, if it's empowering.
Yeah,
if you want to call it a label or a title, or, you know, I mean, this is where the whole idea of the disease model came into place, was to identify a problem, a malady that was causing harm to oneself in some form, or distress, which is where the idea of disease comes from too. And so, you know, if it's empowering, if the person feels that it gives them, you know, something to look at and to describe and to address in their lives, so they can do things differently, I don't have any problem or issue with it. It's not what I believe, and it may not be what they believe every day. Again, it's about belief systems and how they evolve and those different versions of ourselves, right? You know, Paul 3.5 or I don't know. I think I'm getting to 10 point, you know, I think I'm getting to 10.0 here. But this idea that if it speaks to you and I use this word empowering, meaning that it brings strength to your life and your choices, then, you know, use it as a tool. If it becomes just the opposite of something that becomes a hindrance in a way and becomes limiting, then I think we have to explore revising it in some form or another. And I do that in a simple way, because, you know, the idea of being an addict, Well, we just, you know, a few minutes ago, we threw around, a number of us threw around the idea that we're, you know, it's just part of being human, right? Right. So am I going to be addicted to different things at different times in my life? Well, there's a possibility, you know. Have I been addicted to people? Yes. You know, have I been addicted to things? Yes. So yeah. I don't know why people get hung up on this in some ways, except that it becomes a big part of dialogue and how people identify themselves.
My black and white thinking tends to limit. Like, I tend to like feel like I have a belief and it's immovable. I can't change it, or at least that has been a part of my process, right? Uh-huh. It's like, oh, well, I put that out there as my belief, or I told myself that's what I believe, and so I have this experience next week that changes my perception, but I can't betray what I believed last week.
You know? Right, right. Yeah.
And that's just not how I live anymore, or at least not how I try to live. I try to, you know, look at the gray and realize I can believe this last week and not be held accountable to that belief because it's new today. It's different today for me.
Well, that's why I think it's important that we, I think as humans, we approach things from some kind of evolutionary process instead of you know, having a belief system that's, you know, a fixed point.
Like in politics, that's like the most pernicious thing. Like, I'm held to my stance. I feel like, yeah. Like, I don't want to talk politics. I'm just saying that idea. Like, I said this 6 months ago, and now I had this, you know, intimate, vulnerable experience with this topic that changed my opinion, and I can't have a change of opinion.
Yeah.
You're a flip-flopper,
yeah. Like I have done that in my own life. I feel like I can't flip-flop. And yeah. It's like, no, I can. I do. It's not flip-flopping, right?
Yeah, you can evolve. And I can relate to that a lot because that label of alcoholic used to just make me cringe, and it used to bring a lot of shame and guilt when I would hear that. But as I've gone through recovery and moved out of the victim stance, took accountability for, yeah, that I did, I misused alcohol. That if that makes me an alcoholic, then so be it. But I've evolved to where I have enough self-acceptance for the challenges that I've overcome that now if that term gets thrown at me, it doesn't bother me at all. I don't have any shame or guilt around that because, again, you look back and you're like, well, but that's not who I am today.
Right.
You know, if you're asking me to who I am today, I say I would say I'm in recovery, you mm-hmm. know, and working on staying in recovery. So that term or that label doesn't bother me as nearly as it used to.
Right.
It used to really bother me a lot. But now it's like not a big deal. But on the same time, I don't find it as something that I don't gravitate it towards it being empowering either. Like, I'm an alcoholic, you know, and all that, and use it that way. But, you know, some people that works and it can't be empowering for them. For me, it's more empowering to think that's what I was, but now I'm evolved into this.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I agree with that a lot.
Okay. So we're talking about labels you know, we're looking at and, you know, exploring the, you know, when they're important, how we identify with them, and then this idea of why it's also important to be able to detach from those labels, I think is something we should explore a little bit, at least from the aspect of non-attachment appreciation. And I think about this from a couple different aspects, but does, you know, it comes from a place of what serves me, and why does it serve me to see myself as a whole human being, a wholehearted, or what's the book you guys were reading again?
Daring Greatly.
From that aspect, that's that the idea of being courageous and taking risks and being willing to show up and be vulnerable and I for some reason that the empowerment of that seems so important. And I know for myself the idea, and this probably started about 10 years ago, when I began to really sort of shed this, like a skin, I mean, I kind of relate it to a snake a little bit, shedding skin, this idea of losing some of the labeling that had been going on in my life, and not just around drugs or alcohol, in the addict label, but what it meant to, you know, for me to be a father, and how I identified that part of myself, and what it meant to be a partner or a husband or those things too. I kind of look back at that period of time, and I knew it in that moment that the person I was then was, you know, this was 10 years out from or 15 years out from when I did treatment, I was a completely different person. I mean, did I have some still belief systems and similar, and some habits that were similar? Yes. But the person that I was, that, you know, 15 years before that or 10 years before that, there was so much that had changed. And so much of my life had refocused on living more authentically, or more connected to what my true core beliefs were. And it again, evolutionary, it's not defined that that's all of it, just another part, that those labels began to fall away, but some of them began to evolve. And I still today am in a place of looking at what it means to be able to do this from a non-attachment appreciation perspective, meaning that I don't have to hold the label, and this is kind of what I think you were saying, actually, mm-hmm. Brent, before we took the break, was this idea of am I okay one way or the other, or do I have to be attached to one way or the other about it? Am I going to be whole regardless? Is that accurate? Do you think?
Yeah, no, that definitely resonates to me. It's the labels. You can. I think it's a matter of recognizing it, but again, you're not. That's not completely or entirely who you are. It's a matter of, you know, recognizing that might, like you mentioned, it being a father. Well, yeah. So you're a father, but is that all you are? Is that all are you just a father? No, you're multiple things. And so I think it can get a little dangerous with labeling, because if you look at it as all encompassing, mm-hmm. it can be definitely something. And I think you can appreciate you know, those labels, and you can appreciate being certain things in your life, but you don't hold on to that solely as who you are, because, you know, it reminds me of the box of crayons that we talked about earlier, that were many colors,
yeah.
right? And
yeah.
so you can't just attach to you know, seafoam green, you know.
That's your number one, obviously.
That's, you know, so I think that's what we're going with. Is green. That,
by the way, that's one of my favorite colors, just FYI.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a fan favorite. But yeah, you know, just you know, acknowledging it, but that doesn't have to completely define you.
Yeah.
I think that can happen a lot in your career, in your, you know, professional. I think a lot of people, especially if they do feel proud or empowered by their career, use that as a, you know, a main label that would, and other people do too. I think that's one for me that used to be very easy to use, was the career one, even more so than like daughter or addict or all of these other many things I am. And that was a dangerous one for me, was my career, because having it define me and separating from that and going, that's something I do just as I do these other things. But I feel like I know a lot of people that have a hard time deciphering from their identity and their who they are in their career, their professional life.
Seems like we put a lot of meat into the word label. It's just, you know, if you think about the actual what it is, it's just something to describe, you know, using words, something you do. I'm a dad, I'm a husband, I'm a writer, I'm a whatever it is. It's just part of your life.
But you're somewhere a joker, along you're a smoker, you're a midnight toker. Okay.
I get my loving on the run.
Exactly.
It's really just, I don't know, when we talk labels, it sounds like we're trying to describe the essence of someone just with a word based on what we know about that word.
definition of that word or something. I'm trying to describe a whole being with a word.
Sure.
And a symbol.
What's the word? It's just... A symbol. It's not how we really describe ourselves if we're thinking about it.
So true.
There's always an inherent judgment to a label.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Good point. I like the point about, you know, identifying, looking at some kind of identity through a career, though.
Well, that's what people do when they, who are you, Matt?
What do you do?
And everyone brings their job, their career.
Ones to put as your identity.
And it might describe a lot about yourself, but it's not.
Or it might not.
Well, yeah, it could have nothing to do with who you actually are.
Yeah.
Well, as we're going into identity a little bit here.
Well, that's kind of what I think label.
Yeah.
You're identifying something with a label.
So how much does money define your identity?
Zero.
Aw. Well, bullshit.
You said bullshit, right?
Yeah, I said bullshit. I mean,
yeah.
Money's a tricky one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
You're damn right I want a lot of money.
I didn't know that.
I'd rather have a lot of money than not enough money.
No, I mean, it opens doors, it makes things convenient, but you always hear rich people say it doesn't make you
happy.
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 Yeah, I'm going to go bullshit.
Okay. I'm good with that.
Well, like career. I mean, but money's different. Money has a different aspect to it. And it's not one I definitely want to spend a lot of time on today. It did come up and give me a little bit of jolt there when I was thinking about it. So.
Yeah.
All right. One of the things that I wanted to talk about or explore a little bit today, and it kind of already, we've already touched upon a little bit with the victim narrative and the victim stance, is the idea of learned helplessness. And I think about this, too, when we talk about labels and identifying people or identifying ourselves and what becomes empowering, but sort of the disempowerment part when we learn, like we may be taught or been domesticated into a victim mythology or victim narrative, but the idea of what learned helplessness is and how at some point we were all humans experience this sense of helplessness where they lose hope or they find that they don't believe in themselves that they can do certain things. And though today, I mean, you know, probably all of us in this room have a much different slant or view about learned helplessness than we did before. And maybe we didn't even think about it before. But the idea of where that comes from, where we learn that we can't do things. And I can throw a bunch of quick things out there. Obviously, our family dynamics have a lot to do with it. Culturally, there's a lot to, you know, there's a lot of factors that come into this. If we're indoctrinated into any type of theological dogma, that can also sort of, you know, project learned helplessness onto people, especially if we're going to, you know, turn our lives and over to somebody else or something else, you know, that kind of can also lead to some types of hopelessness. But I wonder what you guys think of that.
I think learned helplessness, a lot of it comes from, at least for me, when I look back at times where I felt that way, I think a lot of it is rooted into not the feeling of not being enough, not being good enough, uh-huh. which it therefore translated into I can't do certain things because I'm not good enough to do that. And so because I can't do it, I need somebody to do it for me, mm-hmm. you know? And so I think some learned helplessness does get, is rooted into some shame-based beliefs and shame-based behaviors.
Do you remember at a time in your life maybe where that if you did have that idea that there are things that you weren't able to take care of things or that you felt hopeless at times that you looked to someone else to do that for you? I mean, in particular, you were attracted to someone that thought they could fix you or...
Never.
Never.
Oh, no. I think Sarah wants to take point on this.
Okay, Sarah.
Or being the one
who
wanted to do the fixing.
Right, yeah.
Which is also learned helplessness. It's the same concept, I think, of you have this feeling that you can be the one to make things better, make someone happy, fix things, be the peacemaker in the family, or all of these things. And really, I think the helplessness part comes in when you realize that you can't control those things. Mm-hmm. I can't control those things. I can't control how people are going to feel, or if they're going to be happy, or for me, that was a big part of how I used to feel, and that's been a huge shift for me, is realizing that I'm only in control of myself. I'm not in control of others, and that's okay. And the other part for me with learned helplessness that stemmed a lot from, and I don't even know if this really makes sense, but from comfort or familiarity. Until I started doing things that were harder, and I kind of took that victim stance of, well, this is just kind of as good as it gets. This is just my life. This is where I'm supposed to be. This is what I'm doing. And, oh, I've been at this career now for X amount of years, and It's kind of like a whole it is what it is concept. And that, I didn't realize at the time how much of a victim narrative that was, or learned helplessness, because I actually had someone ask me the other day, well, what made you change careers or make such a drastic move in your career? And besides all of the points of, you know, some alcohol-related issues, the main point that really made me do the jump to what I'm currently doing was choice and not being a victim anymore. Not having that feeling of helplessness of, oh, well, this is just enough because this is kind of, this is where I ended up. This is kind of what Brent said. Like, this is as much, you know, I guess I kind of felt like that's as good as it was going to get or something. Like, I didn't really deserve more to be happier or have other experiences.
Or that you were supposed to do something.
Exactly. That I was supposed to do something else. Yeah. And that went in for me with a lot of just being in a comfort zone most of my life, being familiar with everything I was doing and not wanting to expand that. But when I realized that if that makes me unhappy or makes me, you know, discontent, I actually have a choice. I think learning that, and that same with stopping drinking or getting out of a relationship that's not fulfilling you anymore, all these things are just, they're literal choices that I have that I didn't feel empowered to make for myself for my whole life almost.
Hmm.
Yeah, when I think of learned helplessness, I think of being in helpless situations over time. Like, that's how you learn, right? It's just a culmination of, like, feeling helpless, and there's nothing like some really, like, strong drugs that keep you shackled and helpless, you know?
Enforce that. Drugs definitely reinforce, you know? And helplessness. So, I
mean, all of us can relate to that, where it's like, I didn't leave Utah for like 8 years, or when I did, I left with, you know, disastrous consequences because I was helpless. I was shackled to the substance.
Mm-hmm.
And you learn from doing that time and time again. You know, you give up your freedoms, you give up and you feel helpless, even though you can shift and change that. But when that becomes embedded in who you are for so long, it's hard to rewrite.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And to come out of that.
Yeah, that becomes a strong narrative. There's no doubt. There's no doubt. And definitely substances, the perpetual use of a substance, especially under the guise of addiction or abuse or dependency of it, definitely breeds learned helplessness.
Yeah,
we learn that we're helpless in a sense, or at least I learned I was helpless when I was in the throes of that dependence or that abuse of that substance.
When you are, you wake up you know, not that you don't have the power to change at any given time, because we do, but when you're in that, it's like I wake up in the morning, and what is literally the moment my eyes open, what's the first thing on my mind? It's getting high.
Right.
When I go to bed at night, what's the first thing on my mind? Do I have stuff for tomorrow?
Yeah.
Right. And the whole day goes like that. And so you are so dependent on it that with you can't, you know what I mean? Like, and doing that for so long just really blows up that helplessness, that victim shit, which is why I think, you know, treatment is such, can be such a necessity, not because of even the therapy, or I mean, that's great, necessary, right? But just the fact that you're sheltered, your behavior, you're lifting the fog for 30 or 60 days, right? Yeah. And you have no idea, or I had no idea, what 30 days off of a drug after doing 7 years every day on a drug, what 30 days would feel like, you know?
This also, there's, this happens in relationships too, where and you know, as a therapist, one of the things that I find myself talking to clients about quite often is the helplessness they feel in a relationship that may be toxic for them, and not knowing how to get out of it. It's almost that I don't know what to do to leave it. You know, they become, even though they know it's not a healthy situation to be in, there's sort of a helplessness about making the choice of leaving it. Like, what are the costs associated with that? And can I really do it? I don't know if I'm capable of doing that. Which then leads to, am I capable of being alone, right?
Interesting concept.
Okay. Let's open it up. Who else has a topic today?
I think, going back to earlier when we were talking about happiness and what brings happiness, and I thought one thing I wanted to bring up, but a thought that I had when Brady brought that topic up is, again, as part of our book club, we read the book, The Happiness Equation, and one of the things that he said in the book was a thing that, you know, one of the principles of or, you know, I guess helpful hints. I don't know how you want to classify what his, or tips, I guess, of being happy was remember the lottery. And that when I first read that, I was like, when I just saw the topic, remember the lottery, I'm like, what the hell is he going to talk about? and really what it boiled down to was that the fact that, you know, it's based in being grateful and having gratitude for what you have and where you're at in life. And he said that, 14 out of 15 people that have ever lived are already dead. So you're one of the 1 out of 15 that's still alive. So just being alive, you've won the lottery. And then he also equated that, we talked a little bit briefly about money. He also equated that to money, that, you know, the average world income is $5,000. So if you make, you know, $50,000, you're in the elite 0.05% of the entire population. Mm-hmm. If you make more than $5,000, so again, you've already won the lottery because you're in 99.5% richest people in the world.
Right.
You know, and all of it was just rooted in having gratitude. And I think for me personally, things that have evolved, or for me that has evolved me into a place of contentment in recovery and helped me move out of the victim stance is just being grateful for where I am in my life and what I have been given in my life. And I think a lot of the things that we've read about in our book club and stuff, a lot of it kind of revolves back to gratitude. And and I just think having a gratitude practice or keeping that in mind definitely, for me personally, fosters happiness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that.
When I first entered treatment, someone gave me it's like a strip of tape that you can stick on your wall, and you can write on it with chalk.
Mm-hmm.
It's on my mirror. And for a while, I would change the words on it like once a week, but I've left it on gratitude for about a year now, just because I think that's probably the most important thing for me to remember and keep in mind.
I did a podcast with Todd Sylvester last. Oh no, gosh, it was this week. Jeez. And he asked something that to what would I recommend or what challenge would I put out there to his listeners, and that was my challenge, was to practice gratitude, to either find, you know, create a, you know, at the end of the day, write down, you know, find things that you're grateful for in that day, keeping it simple, finding gratitude in the simple things around us, not having it to be something always big and monumentous that, you know, we're expecting something to happen, but to focus on what on where we can find gratitude in the simple things in life. Yeah. And that it's gratitude is just like a lens. It's like a way to see the world around us. And that idea of approaching life with gratitude and being humble, I think, is like the one of the roots of happiness in so many ways.
I agree.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm right there. I'm right there with that. Yeah.
I agree.
That's a good point, by all means. Anything
gratitude.
Else? Did you have something else on your list?
No, man. I don't think so.
I'll let out this pause, but do we have anything
else? Oh, are we paused?
No, I haven't paused, but I'll just edit this piece out.
Oh.
But if there's anything else you want to talk about today.
I think we jumped around those topics pretty well.
You got anything?
Not really.
Okay. All right. I'm going to ask them. I'm going to ask a music question just to be prepared.
Music question?
Yeah.
Nice.
Okay. So we're about going to wind down here today. I'm going to just kind of toss this around to the group, and any input if you have something, if great. If you don't, that's great too. There's this idea, and you know, in the individual podcasts that we do, that we do here, we ask about, you know, music that's kind of represents your life. But I'd like to ask you guys a music question about what's represented your, in a sense, it's been a strong part of or represented your journey of sobriety, whatever that looked like. Maybe there's a song or there's a type of music that you find inspiring, or maybe even a poem. Well, just leave it to music, but we'll also bring in the poem. And I know we talked about this earlier about the Rumi poem too. So
I have one word for music: Naco.
You're so obsessed right now.
Naco and medicine for the people.
Medicine for the people.
Naco and medicine for the people. Have you listened to that?
Yes.
Oh my god, I love them.
Yeah, they I think they're Red Butte last year.
They were Red Butte this year. Brett and I went.
Oh, that's right.
We did, yeah.
Well, that's right.
Man,
with Dispatch, right. Oh, yeah. That was your song. That was your song, yeah, okay.
I'm part of the Medicine Tribe.
Medicine Tribe, okay.
Warrior, the nerd tribe.
Warrior people. No, dude, check this out. This guy is music for the soul. I mean that guy.
Naco.
Yeah, medicine for the people.
I really connected to Naco and their music while running, like just being out there.
Use that. That's that you use that as you, in your
and Trevor Hall, big recently. Trevor Hall is great. If you
Hall and Oates,
Daryl Hall.
Where are you at?
That's where I've been. I've been in the classic rock lately.
What are you listening to?
A lot of Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin.
And how about you guys? You got anything? Anything that's been inspiring in your...
Well, a song that stands out for me in recovery is Red Hot Chili Peppers' Snow. That song, Snow.
Yes, yeah.
And mainly because there's just one little... I mean, the song itself is awesome, but there's a line in there where he says, all I really need to know, I need to look inside, look inside, you know?
Yeah.
And for me, that really struck a chord when I was, you know, in early sobriety and working to stay in recovery. So, Red Hot Chili Peppers.
It's about drugs in Los Angeles with him.
I hope not.
It is.
But yeah, you know, I that resonates to me.
Yeah. Cool. Sorry, you got anything?
Adele, hello.
Nothing. How did you know?
All right, we're going to end with that.
No, no, just kidding.
Lil' Kim.
I have been listening to a lot of really depressing music lately, though.
Oh, God.
Which is interesting, yeah. I always have listened to depressing music, but then I used to get really depressed when I listened to it, and I kind of liked.
What do you define as depressing music? I'm curious.
Just music that has really depressing lyrics. Like a lot of. So, just in mind, because I went to the concert a couple weeks ago, it was Death Cab for Cutie, and not all of their music is depressing, but a lot of it has really depressing lyrics, and that song actually came to mind because I was listening to it on my way home to, down from Park City today. It popped on, and they had played it at their concert at Red Butte a couple weeks ago. It's called, and that's my name, What Sarah Said. So, I used to listen to it in my addiction, and the whole point of the song is like they're at this hospital and it's the process of like waiting for someone that they love to die.
Oh, I know that song. Yeah. Yes, very well.
And at the end, it just keeps repeating, and who's gonna watch you die?
Yeah.
And for some reason, when I was like right before I remember going into the house, I was listening to that one album, I think it's Plans, a lot, and that song was on there, and I always thought that like, seriously, I've pushed everyone away, and like, you know, kind of that really over dramatic, like, who is gonna watch me die? Like, I'm gonna be alone, like, and everyone hates me. And now I've been listening to it again, and it's taken on this new meaning of kind of because now I'm, you know, recently divorced and stuff. And but it's cool because I definitely don't feel the amount of like for real, like pit in my stomach type, like loneliness or anything over it. But it's been, I've been listening to a lot of those songs since the concert, and I don't feel as depressed listening to them. I just feel kind of like,
So what I'm hearing you say is that the songs the songs that you listened to before were more depressing than you as you're listening to them now.
Exactly. Yeah.
They're changing.
On, right, and I still kind of like the lyrics because it's still kind of, but now it takes on more of a. I don't know why I still like the sad lyrics. I just always kind of have. I just kind of get this, like, inner, like, thought process going with them. But now they don't make me... They don't keep me low. They just kind of make me become more introspective.
Mm-hmm.
But not in a negative way.
Yeah. Where
before, I think I was already down, so I wanted to continue to push down with sad music. Yeah. Where now it's, like, it just makes me kind of think about things in life, but not in a way that's a downer. That's been my thing the last couple weeks since I went to that concert.
So. Oh, beautiful. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I'll give you something. Thanks, guys. I'll give you something to go out on that maybe we'll bring up next time is a little bit on this vein or topic, this idea of death and evolution. And is transcending addiction, is it about letting something within us or some part of us die? Is this, you know, burying that something of us, or, you know, releasing it in such a way that it's not with us anymore? And maybe, again, how we see ourselves or how we listen to ourselves changes in such a way. So we'll bring that up next time. All right. Thanks, guys. Thanks for being here today. Matt, good to have you this week. We kind of missed you a little bit.
You're lying.
All right.
Never.
Guys, okay, we'll be back in about a month or so. Thanks for listening. We'll go out as we always do with little Joan Osborne. Have a good week.